Hey guys, thanks for tuning into Real Blend. On this week's show, we have trailer reactions, a great Mulan debate, and special guest director Rachel Lee Goldenberg, who's talking about her new comedy, Unpregnant. So stay tuned.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 134 of Real Blend, podcast that really wishes it was in Toronto right now. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing director here at Cinema Blend, and boy, oh boy, do we have an episode chock-filled with really great things for you guys, including some enticing trailer talk, reactions to some really big things that are going to be coming our way, Mulan talk, and, you know, I don't know if that's the hill I want to die on, but whenever we have a conversation where two people feel one way and one person feels the other, it gets pretty heated. So we'll see how heated I choose to get over Mulan. And this week, we caught up with the HBO film Unpregnant, and we have Rachel Lee Goldenberg, the director, as our guest. But before we get into the show proper, let me introduce the guys to you in case you're joining us for one of the very first times. I'm going to start with Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C., who is going to see Tenet for the 11th time tonight. Hi, Kev. How are you?
37th. Come on, Sean, get that right.
Sorry,
I'm trying to get to the Kevin Smith Clerks number. No, I fourth time for Tenet. I've seen it three times. It's I couldn't be more excited to see it again as I was the first time.
I have a lot of questions for you about how it's playing, but we'll wait till we get there. Because we have to introduce Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hi, Jakey. How are you?
Doing well, man. I've only seen Tenet once because I'm an adult and I have shit to do.
Well, I thought you went a second time. Did you not?
No, not yet.
Oh, okay. Anyway, I like your first man shirt. That's nice.
Thanks.
Did you get that for free?
Of course I got it for like 80% of my wardrobe is either a boy's large shirt from Baby Gap or movie swag.
Gotcha. All right. Plugs. I want everybody to know that we are posting our episodes onto Cinema Blend's YouTube pages. So if you're watching us right now and also seeing Jake's free t-shirt, you know that we have the videos posted here. So do me a favor and hit subscribe and turn on your notifications. The Nolan interview blew up, is doing really, really well in terms of its views, and it's helping us build us some subscribers, which has been great. Of course, we are also available all different places that you can get your podcasts. And then this week in particular, we are doing something really, really cool. No, wait, next week. We're doing something really cool. Next week. I just got to get the dates right. We are teaming up with Warner Brothers for a really cool opportunity that's going to take place on their YouTube page. They're going to have a series of documentaries that they're going to air each night from September 15th through the 22nd. I want to say it is. Gabe, you will clarify for that with me in a second. And each night they're going to dedicate a documentary to a specific filmmaker. Martin Scorsese gets one evening. Clint Eastwood gets one evening. They have Frank Darabont and a documentary about the Green Mile. Stanley Kubrick is going to get an evening. And Warner Brothers asked your friends at Real Blend to host this series. And so we will have introductions that we're doing for the documentaries. And then throughout each one, we're going to be live tweeting it using our socials and using Real Blend's socials as well, too. So a really great opportunity that we're super excited for and thrilled that Warner Brothers asked us to do that. We're going to be kicking off with a quick intro to the filmmakers starting on. So, Gabe, what's the date? It's Tuesday the 15th, right?
Tuesday the 15th, and through Friday, and then there's a break over the weekend, and it picks up with a documentary on the following Monday and the following Tuesday. And for the folks at home, we really want to see the Blenders sort of participating, hanging out with us, joining in on the conversation using hashtag WB Filmmakers. That's the official hashtag for the event. We love chatting with you guys every week, and we want to see you come along and take a look at these documentaries and hang out.
And just to clarify, the YouTube channel it's on is the Warner Bros. Home Video channel. To clarify on that. Okay.
Yes, yes, yes.
And it's cool.
You can check the description. I'll have links and everything in there for you to find out where to stream.
The Scorsese one specifically is geared towards Goodfellas. Fury Road, a Mad Max Fury Road one, and George Miller. The Clint Eastwood one's kind of like a career retrospective, but it's geared towards Unforgiven.
I mean, he's been kind of their golden boy for a long time, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Has he worked with any other studio? Has it always been Warner Brothers?
I mean, every time I've ever interviewed him in my career has been a Warner Brothers film.
And I think he has an office on the Warner Brothers lot.
That's awesome.
He's one of the brothers.
Yeah. Can you imagine getting to the point in your career where you just get an office on the Warner Brothers lot?
That's pretty great.
Than heaven. That's pretty amazing.
And remember that time we all got to interview him on the same day and got to share that experience?
That was so awesome.
And what is probably going to be his last on-screen performance?
You think it will be? Oh, that's
interesting. I think the mule will be his last one.
It's interesting. Yeah, it very well could be. Although you never know with him. He turns out a movie or two a year. Which is something
in between golf outings.
Yeah, true.
I want Unforgiven 2. Forgiveness.
Unforgivable.
That's so stupid.
Unforgivable.
As long as you're not asking for Jersey Boys 2, then I'm fine with that. That's just fine. My favorite Clint Eastwood story doesn't even involve me. It involves Kevin getting a chance to interview him haphazardly at Sully. And Kevin wasn't even supposed to interview him. Clint just decided he was going to hop into a room, and he was eating peanuts the entire time. So we have a number of photographs that we share in the Roblend text chain, and one is one that I've saved that's just Clint with peanuts up to his mouth.
I have never felt more honored for someone to talk to me with their mouth full and ever in my life than that moment.
It's such an interesting thing. We've all interviewed him, and so there is definitely this attitude of like he just genuinely doesn't care anymore. But I've never felt that attitude toward myself or the interview. Sure, he may sit in an interview and like eat peanuts while he's talking to you, but he's giving you such incredible. Yeah. Like I've never walked out of a room with him and thought like, oh, that could have gone better. Like he is still at 90, at nearly 90.
Yeah.
Oh, what a. I cannot wait to see that documentary.
There was nothing disrespectful about it. Jake and I had a chance to talk to him recently for Richard Jewell, and like he stood up, shook our hands when we walked in. We got like 8 minutes with him or whatever it was. We had like extra time with him, whatever. But in the case that Sean's referring to, when he was eating peanuts, it wasn't because he was being rude.
He just wanted some peanuts.
He was just Clint Eastwood. He was hungry.
Well, it's a movie about flying too, so he just assumed to fly peanuts.
they were airline peanuts. How did I not know that?
Yeah. Anyway, all right, Planters. Weekly poll. So we threw a weekly poll up heading into the weekend because Mulan was going to be made available on Disney Plus, and you would have to pay an additional $29.99 in order to see it, the premium price to get the what should be a first-run film going to theaters, but Disney decided they were going to go the streaming service route. And so we simply asked you guys, are you going to pay for Mulan this weekend or not? And yes or no. So, Jake, what do you think won? Yes or no? And try to guess the percentages.
Sure. If it were sort of the general public, I would lean toward no. But because the people that tend to follow our podcast tend to be pretty big movie fans, I'm going to say that yes was the winning answer.
Interesting.
But I'm going to say that it's maybe not as big of a number as Disney Plus would like to hear. So I'm going to say it's going to be like a 55.
All right. Your logic is sound. But you are completely wrong.
Am I?
The no's actually scored 83% of the vote.
Wow. And you know what's funny? Sometimes I vote because I really do have an opinion. I purposefully did not vote because obviously we all got screeners.
Yeah.
And so I did not want to diffuse the legitimacy of the poll.
Well, the poll, it got 237 votes. People do play along, but people just did not want to. And I don't, have you guys seen statistics or numbers on what it did? I know they don't reveal that stuff.
They haven't released them, which is never a good sign.
Yeah. I paid $30 to see it, unfortunately. Not unfortunately, why? But I here's why. So when the screener, they sent us a screener for the film, and I wasn't able to watch it until Friday morning, the day it came out, because I was reviewing it for my 10 o'clock hour, and I was going to watch it in between my segments because I had like a little break. So I go online to get my online screener. I'm like, yay! And I click on the link.
Expired.
And like, it's gone. And I'm like, we've already been teasing all morning. Kevin's review of Mulan coming up at 10:15. I'm like,
that's got some TV anxiety.
All right, well, we're going to do it.
That's a Tenet ticket.
At least.
I bought six of them for tonight, so I spent a lot of money on Tenet so far.
You're treating everyone to Tenet now?
I am trying to bring people to the theater so they can see it. That's right. What I'm trying to do.
You would think its domestic numbers would be higher just because of you.
Kevin alone. For some reason in the DMV, we are dominating.
Nolan's movies are crushing in Northern Virginia for some reason.
We are going to get to a full breakdown of Mulan later on in the show, and you'll sort of see where we're going when we get to that point. But first, we want to get to our interview. So Unpregnant is a film that's coming to HBO Max. We got to sit down with the writer and director, Rachel Lee Goldenberg. Terrific interview for a really sweet film. And so without further ado, our interview on the Real Blend podcast on behalf of Unpregnant. Hi, Rachel. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah. So this movie has really important lessons about a woman's choice and outdated, out of touch state laws, but it's also a goofy road comedy. And I really wanted to talk to you about balancing the two to make sure that one didn't overwhelm the other as you were putting it all together.
Yeah. Well, so the tone was sort of the whole thing in this movie, like finding the right balance. And what I was attracted to about it was I love things that are sort of hard to define and mixed genres and mixed tones. And so, you know, the idea that this film has such an important message that, you know, that she shouldn't have to drive 1,000 miles to have access to abortion, but that journey can become, you can derive all this comedy and all this adventure and all of these different action-y moments from that journey is why I think it's such a brilliant idea for a book and then for a film. And, you know, and what made me excited to sort of roll my sleeves up and jump in as a director.
So I have a 16-year-old and a 12-year-old. And I caught little elements of things that just made it very contemporary. Them constantly needing the need to update on social media and just stop and take pictures of things that resonated with them. What are some aspects or elements as you were going through the story that you knew you needed to include so that it appealed to a more contemporary sort of teenage audience?
You know, I was really thinking about it from a character perspective. So Veronica's thing, her journey through the film is about her sort of being okay with who she is and not putting up fronts. And so, you know, it's not that she, I'm not even criticizing the use of social media so much as that her use of social media is really to try to create this facade of look how perfect everything is and vibes and blessed and like everything's great. And so I wanted that was a device to show that she sort of had her head in presenting this image and that, you know, that the journey is for her to figure out that she can be herself and sort of, you know, come back from that back into the real world.
Did you ever get feedback from the cast, from the girls in particular, that maybe just said, we wouldn't do this or this doesn't feel right?
Yes, but none of it's in the movie because then we talk about it and we sort of figure out, you know, I love working with both Haley and Barbie are really smart actors and they come with perspectives. And we have talked a lot about their character and a lot about their relationship and their backstory and this whole journey. And so as we go through and rehearse or discuss, they'll say, you know, I wouldn't say that, or why would I say that? Or this is, you know, and even me hearing them say it sometimes, you know, you'll realize, oh, that's too forward for Haley, for Veronica to say in this moment. Or
sure.
Or, you know, a Bailey wouldn't be so vulnerable this early in the movie, or, you know, whatever it is. And so that's working with smart actors and really digging in and letting it sort of evolve and change is part of the process.
Absolutely. You know, you could do a road trip comedy and there are certain beats that almost all of them hit. And I thought you kind of avoided most of them. Were there road trip movie cliches that you specifically sort of circled and said, no, I don't want to be part of this because we want to stand out and do something different?
No, I think, you know, because I love playing with genres, I thought that was, we played into and then played against some, for example, you know, just like that moment when the girls are screaming out of the limo and then Haley's feeling so free and she throws her phone and then they have to stop and get the phone. So, you know, I like those little misdirects like that where you sort of play into a cliche and then turn it on its head. But, you know, I mean, my inspirations were, I mean, the road trip movie that I was most inspired by is Thelma and Louise, which is just, you know, one of my absolute favorite films. Yeah. But then, you know, we're drawing from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and we're drawing from Get Out and from Mad Max Fury Road and like all these different things. And so, you know, it's really about just blending those different things and making it its own unique product that hopefully no one can say, hey, this is just like X movie, you know?
Right, right. And Road Trip, I hope you had Breckenmeyer show up.
It's true.
Pick his brain for a little bit, see how he did it. Was it always Kelly Clarkson? It's when you hit the moment that it really is a song that drives everything forward.
Kelly Clarkson is actually, it's in the book.
Okay.
But it's also just a song. It's, you know, there, it's one of a handful of songs that are like the songs that you can scream at the top of your lungs to. Sure.
Yeah.
So I was so glad that we were able to use it because it was hard to think of what we could replace it with, if not that.
There was a line too that made me laugh, which was, you know, who takes a pregnancy test at school? And is that from the book? And is that also maybe kind of inspired by stories that you heard from girls?
You know what is funny? So no, that wasn't from the book. That was, I think that's something that my writing partner and I brought to it. But I was showing the movie to I believe 14-year-old to get her notes on an early cut of the film, and she texted me a couple of days later and said, "Oh my God, we found a pregnancy test in my high school in my bathroom at my school." And I was like, "Well, there, I guess it's not as far fetched as you might think." You know, I mean, I think it speaks to, you know, Veronica's discomfort with having anything like that in her house. You know, that's why she ends up on this journey, because she knows she can't. Couldn't be caught dead with that at home. So where do you go? You go to your high school bathroom. It's not ideal, certainly.
I also love this. Just little lines that you slipped into that just made me laugh because they were not necessarily out of place, but like when she wakes up in the morning and sees the giant cross hanging over them. And the other girl says, like, how did we miss that? It's just a great beat. It's a really good comedic beat.
I mean, if you fall asleep in the dark, there has to be something funny when you wake up that you didn't expect, you know, it feels natural to have something there.
I want to ask you to walk me through the staging of what I thought was one of the most beautiful scenes, which is them on the carnival ride. And them shouting out their true confessions and your decision to sort of mount the camera so that it faces them and we're riding with them. Are they actually on a ride? How did you do that?
On a ride. I am the mean director who made them do that ride 8 times for all our different coverage and shots. You know, that scene is really important to me. And it was an adventure even to find the right ride, the perfect ride where it's two people sitting next to each other. That's the right, that it's genuinely scary, but not so scary that you can't get any dialogue out. I think the first take, they didn't get any dialogue out. I think the first take, they were just screaming the whole time, but then we got some dialogue. To me, it's actually sort of a nice metaphor for the movie because it's this serious scene where they're speaking their truths and it's this intimate conversation, but we put it in this wild scenario and made it cinematic and made it big and made this serious conversation become a total adventure. And so it's a scene that's particularly close to my heart.
It was so moving. It was really moving. And I just love the way that you guys decided to stage that visually. So I'll get you out of here on this last one, because we see a lot of these road trip movies where people have to get to a certain destination by a certain time. And they're constantly figuring out miles and how much time they have to get there. How much thought goes into that? Is it legitimately accurate where you're actually looking at the map and figuring out where the protagonists are in different places and how long it would take them to get?
Yes, I have. I my writing partner and I have some intricate chart we made somewhere of like where they are, when and what time. And it does all work. At least when we wrote it, it did all work. So it should all line up. Yeah. Cause we want, you know, being, the visuals of having each state feel different was important to me and each location they go to. And so really having that, journey feel visual and feel specific, and not just like, I don't know, they're on the road, go, but like really caring about each moment and each step and each setting was, you know, was part of the figuring out.
Well, it resonated and it carried it beyond their chemistry, which was really, really great. So I'm excited for people to see it. So thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it, Rebecca.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much to HBO Max for setting up that interview. And I'm going to give my review for Unpregnant a little bit later in the show. But we want to get to talking points right now, starting with the Dune trailer. Okay, so full disclosure, we are recording this the day before the Dune trailer releases officially, and I'm the only one who was able to get a link to see the full trailer before it drops. However, these guys were both able to see the reel that got put before it. So they're gonna react to that. I will give a little bit more insight based on the full trailer that we saw. And by the time you guys listen to this when we drop it, you will have all been able to see the trailer for Denis's new film completely. And one of the conversations we were having before the show even started is whether or not Warner Brothers expects to make a ton of money with Dune, whether Dune is going to make a lot of money. Because
we're getting part one of two, very similar to what happened with It.
Yes, very much so. But also, like, they invested a ton of money in Blade Runner 2049, and it's more big screen, epic storytelling science fiction from Denis Villeneuve, who people know from Arrival, and of course Blade Runner 2049, but a book that has a lot bigger following than probably the Blade Runner franchise.
Do you think
is Arrival his most successful film? Sorry, Jake.
No.
Prisoner?
I would say so. Because I think it crossed 100 million domestic.
Arrival made 203 worldwide, 102 domestic. I think it might be his most successful film.
Might be. Prisoner's...
Technically speaking, Blade Runner 2049 would be, because it made 250, I guess, technically speaking. I guess if you look at the budget compared to what it made, I don't know.
When it comes to the whole part one and part two thing, do you guys think that this film that's coming out, hopefully this year, is going to end in a cliffhanger and sort of a like, oh my God, part two's... Or do you think they're going to play it safe? Because remember with It, like if It had just been on its own... Mm-hmm. It would have been fine. Like they implied, like, okay, we have to come back if we're adults. I like part two. but it could have just been on its own. And in fact, I don't know if you remember when It ended, the title card actually says It Chapter One. And I remember people in my theater was like, wait, what do you mean? What do you mean Chapter One? What does that mean? And I was like, oh, actually they come back. It's not as good. So I'm curious as to if Dune is going to end with like a Dune chapter, if it's going to imply that there's more to it, or if it's going to be sort of its own self-contained movie.
So here's my, okay. So to Jake's question, I then have questions as well, kind of feeding off what Jake is saying. So, all right. So to clarify, the movie that Denis made, the two-part film we're going to see is based on just the first book, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, are there other books?
There's a bunch of other books. In fact, his son took over it at one point.
Right.
Yeah, no
so I guess my question is this. Who on here has read the book? Gabe and Jake?
Did Jake finish it?
Okay.
Jake finished it.
Okay. Where in the first book do you think would be a good breaking point? Like, if you do you remember at all like a point in which the story could have... I'm hoping to Jake's
Gabe.
Point.
But wait, this is spoilery because I asked Gabe this specifically, and he thinks he knows, but it's a spoiler to kind of reveal it.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to go that far because I think there are going to be a lot of people that have not read the book that are going to enjoy this.
Okay,
Gabe, I texted you.
There is a natural point in the story where the first movie can and probably should end.
Do you think it could be there, Gabe?
I think so. I haven't read... I'm about to start rereading it tonight, actually. So I haven't read it in like a decade. But I think what you said is right. I think that'll be like the big third act moment.
If anything, I think they would move that... Even if it's not in the middle of the book, I think they would move that forward to have it be a thing that happens.
Right. Yeah.
This is a fun conversation
this
for
really
two people.
I kind of get it.
I actually kind of like it too, and I guess my question is going off of what Jake would just ask was, will there be like some kind of like cliffhanger aspect to it? You guys were just talking about that.
Because, but remember,
I hope he doesn't do that.
One kind of had to play it safe because he hadn't filmed Chapter Two yet. If he's already if Denis already filmed all of Dune, then it doesn't really he can have a massive cliffhanger because like they gotta come back for part two.
Technically, he could continue to move the ending until it gets released.
Yeah.
Technically, if it's all shot. I mean,
but let's talk about the trailer in particular or what he's leading off with here. And the one thing that really blows me away is just the cast. I mean, the cast is unbelievably stacked. When you just rattle off Timothy Chalamet, obviously as Paul, who's the lead character. I thought it was interesting. Zendaya has been saying in interviews that she's not really in this movie a lot. Like, they lead with her in the trailer, and I guess she might be significant to later parts of the story, but she's like a vision that Paul keeps seeing, but I don't think that she's going to be in it as much as people are letting you know, because it's a training bit. Like, it's Paul coming up through the ranks and learning to become a leader for his family, and his mentor is Josh Brolin. He's eventually going to... I think...
Brolin.
It's a way I'm kind of just... of pulling this, he's going to end up someplace where he runs into Momoa and Javier Bardem and all these other characters. Is that right, Gabe? Somewhat?
That sounds right. Yeah. There's a big there's a big shift that I think the book makes sense for two parts. One, it's incredibly dense.
Yeah.
In like a very like Tolkien sense.
You have to use the glossary. You legit have to use the glossary.
But there's so much that happens within the book. It's not like a beginning, middle, and end. There are so many shifts that I think it makes sense for a major shift to happen. And then
this is
a second movie.
A question that I asked when I wrote up the story about the trailer, though. Denis is not a filmmaker who waits for the audience to catch up with him. So I really kind of wonder,
like Nolan.
Yeah. Like how much is it going to be beneficial for people to read the book before they go? Because I don't think Denis is going to be the type of person to hold your hand. If you're saying it's the type of book that you need to use the glossary to keep up, like, am I going to be totally lost?
Whenever I cracked it open and started reading chapter one, it feels like you opened it in the middle and just started reading because it very casually uses terminology that there's no way you would know what it means.
But I think that won't be an issue of one. I think that I think Denis is just an incredible visual storyteller. I think he knows. I think it'll be important to him that the audience be able to enjoy it.
Yeah.
But so much of the glossary thing that you're doing is because there's not a visual element. There are things where like you see in the trailer, like there's like a woman who's like, you know, teaching him or something like that. But you can see the way that she's dressed and the way that other people are dressed, that she's a part of some sort of, you know, organization, like a nun or something like that. You know, like there's enough visual context clues that I think he can build all the stuff that you would maybe reach for the glossary to be like, okay, what does this random word mean? I think he can kind of fill in the blanks for you visually.
Gabe, give me the story pitch on Dune. If you were to explain
can I
simply.
Do it too?
Jake, go ahead.
Like if you were to, I'll be honest with you. I have not seen Lynch's movie and I do not know a ton about the Dune story. So for me, I'm planning on seeing the film without reading the book. So if you were to pitch that to an audience, how would you explain it?
I would say that this book was a major influence on George Lucas and the first Star Wars. Mm-hmm. So think of Paul Atreides as Luke Skywalker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
And he kind of like has to go to Dagobah to train, and he has to learn what it means like to be a Jedi, which is the Dune, like the Dune, you know, or the Dune version of like what's going to drive me nuts is if audiences see this and they don't know enough background on it and they're like, oh, they just ripped off Star Wars.
Yeah.
So that's, I would say pretty much exactly that. And I think what I usually tell people is that what Tolkien is to like fantasy, Frank Herbert and Dune is to sci-fi fantasy. Like that's, I think it's on that level of invention and sort of world building. It's very big, but exciting.
Like sandworms.
Yeah. Going back to the question about how dense it is and how confusing the film might be, and kind of what Sean was saying. You know, when you're a filmmaker like a Chris Nolan, for example, with Tenet, you obviously have Final Cut. It's almost like you make the movie you want to make and you just put it out there because your name is, you know, that big of a deal. Is Denis at that level? And the reason I ask that is, do you think Denis had to take notes in regards to from the studio saying, I need you to make this a little easier to comprehend. I need you to, you know, because I feel like Nolan probably wouldn't take those notes. I'm assuming that he's just, you know, it's his work.
I don't think Denis has the kind of power over Warner Brothers that Nolan has. In the sense, because I mean, I would sort of use the junket comparison. Like if we're at the junket, and we're at the Tenet junket, and we don't get Nolan, we're like, oh my god, like, that's the name.
That's a good point.
If we're at the Dune junket, and we don't get Denis, like, okay, sure, but there are a lot of other people that we could be getting that are, you know, that are equally big names.
Here's the thing, though. I don't think you adapt Dune unless you're going to do it right, or don't do it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but Tenet is the type of film where, if it doesn't make sense to the audience, Nolan made the movie he wanted to make. And like, as we're seeing from reactions, people are having trouble understanding some of it and going back and revisiting it. I'm just wondering if Dune's going to be that loose. Like if they're going to let Dune be what it really is, or is it going to be a little bit more geared towards a better understanding?
Well, all right. Well, let me ask a different question too, because until we figure out the plot, how does it look on the big screen? Cause I haven't seen, the only thing I've seen is on my laptop.
Oh my god. I mean, I've seen the trailer three times on the IMAX screen. It is unbelievable.
Really?
Okay. I mean, it is so large. It's so funny because the first thing I think about when the trailer pops up is Seven. Because doesn't he say what's in the box? And he has that like sharp thing up against his his temple.
Yeah.
And he essentially said, like, you know, and it's like this. I thought it was actually a really interesting teaser. It wasn't your standard like 15-second, 30-second teaser.
And that's going to be
like,
that's going to be a very early scene. That's like going to be within the first 15 minutes, that that box scene.
Is that scene from the book?
Oh, yeah. That's like that's like first. What would you say, Gabe? Like 10 pages of the book?
Yeah, that's how it opens. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So let me continue asking stupid questions. What are the breathable things from the nose? What are those meant to be in the story?
It's I wouldn't harp
is that
on
a spoiler?
It. Well, I'll give you this. I don't think this is a spoiler. It's a Dune is called Dune because Arrakis is the planet that his family is going to sort of take control over as a part of this galactic empire. And it's a desert planet. And so those are devices to help you survive on a desert planet. I'll go that far. There's more to it. There's more nuance.
There's a whole
to,
spice thing.
Yeah. Spice is this big export from that planet. It goes on and on and on. But it's but that's pretty much all it is. I wouldn't look into it too much. There are some
things. Is it similar to why you would need the mask and inversion in Tenet? Like you need
not
it for the world.
Well, not
in
like a mechanic. Not in like a plot mechanic way. That's just like a
visual choice.
It's important to the people of Arrakis to survive on a desert planet, essentially.
Dude, you ruined it, Gabe. God. Yeah.
In the end,
now.
Everyone dies.
Not even
I'm
going.
Just playing the person who doesn't know a ton about Dune. That's I'm just
no,
not.
No, at all.
Yeah, you know. Yeah.
Oh,
so.
For whatever reason, Michelle's go-to, anytime she misunderstands what's happening in a movie, she just thinks characters are dead. I only bring that up because we were watching the Charlie Kaufman movie, which is awful, by the way. And the whole, like, with 30 minutes to go in the movie, she just keeps saying, like, oh, everyone's dead in this movie. Oh, they're all dead. Oh, this person's been. I don't know
but did you, by any thing. Chance, did you? Now I know we're making a tangent, which Gabe asked us not to do. Did you read what the explanation for the book is?
No. Should I?
Here's what I'll say. I did because I'm with you in that I did not understand. I don't know if you guys remember. Whenever I was watching it a couple of weeks ago, I was like super guys. Like I'm real. Oh my god, I'm into this. And then by the end, I think I specifically texted you guys, I've never gone so quickly from this movie is on my top 10 list to fuck this movie within such a short amount of time.
It really.
Now, I don't think you ever liked it as much as I did. Now,
No.
You hate it much more than I do by the end, but I don't think you were ever as high on it as I was.
I kept a very open mind for 30, 45 minutes of just because it is really weird. And I was just like, okay, I'm going to let this movie take, it's Charlie Kaufman, obviously. Yeah. I'm going to let this movie take me pretty far. And I watched it like, for people who watching the YouTube, I was like this most of the time. Like just trying to figure out like what is
especially
going
in the house.
On. Yeah, and then at one point I just said, like, I'm going to stop trying to figure this movie out. I'm just gonna ride the wave, whatever it's on.
At what point did you think of ending the film?
Like, with 20 minutes to go is when it finally jumped off the rails, and I just couldn't be like, no more. Yeah, I heard you, Kevin. I got you.
No, I was just looking at the game.
All right, anyway, we were not talking about that. We were talking about Dune. The trailer is up. You guys can watch it now. In addition to that, yes, what?
How's the trailer? Tell us how it is. You've seen it.
Oh, it's amazing. No, it's amazing. I mean, it looks phenomenal. I don't know what you guys saw as part of the teaser, but most of the same thing. It still just looks like there's a part of it that's heavy on character introduction, right? Like it's here's Timothy Chalamet. Here's Rebecca Ferguson. Here's Oscar Isaac.
Well, there's a lot of that in the teaser. The teaser was sort of like his hand in the box with the needle to him. And then it sort of felt like it was quick cuts of like, here's all the people we have in this movie.
But did you get the great, Pink Floyd song? The haunting version of Pink Floyd. It's Dark Side of the Moon. They have a new, I don't know whose cover it is, but they use a version of Dark Side of the Moon in the trailer and it's phenomenal. It just fits the visuals. So it's great. It's like the first half is like character montage introduction. And then it hits a moment where it's like, boom, here's just all of the big screen Denis stuff that's coming in. It's like ships and deserts and Momoa with a knife and all this amazing stuff. And then it ends with the sandworm. Did you see the sandworm? Did they show the sandworm? The sandworm's not in. Okay, so the trailer ends on a massive sandworm, but with a perspective shot of two characters, and one of them's Timothy, and I think the other one might be Momoa. I'm not sure. And in the frame, the way that they are with this sandworm, it's massive and it's amazing. It's great. It's great. It looks incredible, and I can't wait for you guys to see it. It's gonna be really, really phenomenal. So anyway, Dune.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
The other trailer that dropped is for Rebecca, which is a adaptation of a classic novel. But the main reason that most of us know it is because Hitchcock adapted it years and years and years and years and years ago, very early in his career. But this new version is from Ben Wheatley. It's coming to Netflix and it stars three people who I think are perfectly cast in it, Lily James, Armie Hammer, and Kristen Scott Thomas. What did you guys think of the trailer for Rebecca?
I okay, here's the deal. If the purpose of a trailer is to make you want to see the movie, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I watched this trailer.
Sure, yeah.
What it did was make me want to go back and watch the 1940 Rebecca.
No kidding,
like,
really?
Why? Like, because it didn't really feel like they made any effort to give a different angle other than, like, it's shot with newer technology with different actors and it's in color. Like, I mean, if they'd set it in 2020, maybe they'd try to do, like, a different kind of twist on it. But, like, why, you know, it almost, like, boils back down to the whole, like, Disney live. Like, why would I watch that when the other Rebecca exists?
Oh, because I just think Lily James and Armie Hammer look really great in those parts. There are certain actors who you can dress them in period garb and it fits them better almost. I think Lily James looks out of place in contemporary films. The only time that I think she really fit, how many has she actually done now that I think
about
it?
Baby Driver?
It's Baby Driver. And I thought she fit in that mold, but she just seems destined to be in things like Downton Abbey. Or this version of Rebecca or Cinderella, which she's in.
Okay, sure.
I think she's great in that, so.
But, like, do we need this? I know this is such a cliched argument when it comes to remakes. But, like, do we need this movie?
I'm truthfully looking forward to it. I thought it looked really beautiful.
Honestly, like, my first thought was, ooh, I'm going to go back and rewatch the Hitchcock one before this one comes out.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about that idea. I'm excited about having an excuse to go back and watch the old Rebecca, and not so much excited about the prospect of, like, I'm going to have to watch the new Rebecca too.
Well, and Kev reminded us, so it's on Criterion? They have a Criterion version?
Yeah, I just ordered the Criterion for Hitchcock's film, 1940, which I'm looking forward to seeing it. So,
80 years.
I want to say it was a Best Picture nominee, or did he get a Best Director? I know he never won.
Only Oscar.
I know he never won, but I want to say Rebecca was a Best Picture winner. Gabe's going to produce and look that up. All right,
I think Rebecca won something. Yeah.
So let's get to that when it comes back around. So it's starting to feel like, and part of the reason why I talked about missing Toronto. Yes, Gabe.
Sorry, it won Best Picture and it won Best Cinematography.
Hey. So, but did Hitchcock get an Oscar for producing?
It might be his only Oscar. I think it was old Selznick was the. Sole producer is all I'm seeing noted here. I only see David O. Selznick.
That's pretty early in Hitchcock's career. He might not have been producing it yet.
These days, that's why so many directors try to get producing credits. Because I, whenever, and I this was a screw up on my part. Whenever I was interviewing Oliver Stone and he showed me his Oscar, he said, "This is for Platoon." And I said, "Was that director or picture?" And he said, "No, I didn't get the one for picture." He goes, "I probably should have because I was like a big part in that movie being made. So right. I should have been producer on it. He goes, now I wish I had been. But he only got the director one. I mean, not only got the director one, but he won for best director, but didn't get to take home one when it won best picture.
Wow. You guys want to talk about how the producer role has changed in 80 years, at least on IMDb. The only producer that I see listed is David O. Selznick.
Oh, and who's nowadays, an incredibly prolific
producer, yeah. But this is the only producer listed.
Nowadays, movies wow. have like 12 producers. Yeah.
Well, now they have to, like, when it comes down to deciding who gets the Oscar for Best Picture, they really like, don't they have a committee that kind of determines, okay, how much did you actually have an impact okay. on this movie? And they sort of kind of, they'll scratch off, but they'll be like, okay, like you now, you don't get it. You don't get it. You don't get it. Okay. You had it. Like you would get it. You would get an Oscar. That way they don't have like 30 people up there grabbing Oscars when a movie wins Best Picture.
Isn't it also strange that executive producer is a lower person on the producing scale than just producer?
Is it really?
I always thought executive.
Like executive producer usually to me implies, usually it's a pretty big celebrity name. But yeah. usually to me, I always take executive producer as like a big name that like gave him some money, but didn't really have anything to do with it. Create like a lot of times, like you'll see like Brad Pitt, especially with all of his Plan B stuff. You'll see Brad Pitt as executive producer. He probably wasn't on set or didn't do much, but he probably helped fund it. So he gets the executive producer status.
I think the way it's a big gray area, but I think the way it's usually defined is like an executive producer helps a film get made. A producer, depending on the type of producer, because there's different roles there, are actually spending the day to day getting it made,
right.
making it, doing all
They're
that.
More important than the executive producer. But you would think executive producer would be more important just because of the name of it, and it's not.
Right.
This is a genuine story that relates. It's not meant to be any kind of a humble brag or anything, but whenever I was 18 and I was doing some work with the local PBS station in Houston, I helped produce a documentary called The Last 24, and it was about the last 24 hours before a big theatrical production opened in Houston. And when we were gearing up for like the Emmys to like put it up for the Emmys for consideration and stuff, we genuinely had to have a sit down discussion for each person that was listed as a producer. Okay, how much did you do? Like, what did you like? How did so that way? Whenever the nominations came out for Best Documentary, if we were nominated, we had to know who was going to like actually get a trophy. Huh. And we like there was like a, like seriously like names were broken down in terms of like that guy didn't really like. Like, yeah, he kind of helped us get it on the air, but he didn't really do much. And we kind of had to break down each role to determine.
Did you make the cut?
I did make the cut.
Good for you.
So,
did you get nominated?
I did get nominated, but then I lost.
Aw.
Oh, that was one of the most important lessons I've ever learned in my life, because we were nominated for Best Documentary and then a couple of other technical stuff. And throughout the night, we kept winning, like Best Cinematography, Best Direction, Best Writing. And so different people at our table were getting up and like going and like getting there, and to the point where I was like, shit, like I'm 18 years old. I'm about to win my first Emmy. Like it's, and I was like planning, like, okay, I need to walk around that table and I need to move past them. I got to scooch past this guy.
No.
And I was like, I had it determined like how I was going to get to the stage. Even though I wasn't even going to be the guy to speak, like we'd already determined there was like the main guy was going to speak. And then I'll never forget, like we got beaten by a documentary about a chicken. it was like, and the Emmy goes to, and I was like getting like about to stand up, and I was like Clucky the Chicken, and I was like, what do you mean, like a documentary about it? Like it was, but honest to God, that was one of the most important lessons I've ever learned in my entire career.
Don't you know, Jake? You have to give the approving. Oh yeah, yeah.
I did not. I did not get.
Of course, it was Clucky. Yeah.
I think my like you know if they'd had like the still frame like as they were pulling away, it would have been me going like.
They should give Oscars to the people who have to not win.
Because that's yeah, like
the performance they give when they don't get their name called is genuinely brilliant performing.
Dude, like, I've like, gone down amazing. So many wormholes of watching Oscar reveals just to pay attention to the people who don't win.
But it's amazing.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. But by then they almost know.
Yeah. But these days, yeah, they're so because it's the last award given out after like 30 awards. So like...
You know who didn't know? Glenn Close.
She really
that one.
Know.
Oh, have you guys ever seen that shot?
I wonder how close it was.
Have you guys ever seen that shot of when Eddie Redmayne beat Michael Keaton for Best Actor, and the camera's following Eddie Redmayne up onto the stage? You can see Michael Keaton putting his speech back in his pocket
for Birdman, right?
For Birdman, Birdman. As great as Eddie Redmayne was, and in that role, Theory of Everything. I wish we lived in a world where Michael Keaton had an Oscar.
He should be better.
He should have won for Multiplicity.
And that's why we don't get Keaton for The Flash.
All right, let's move on to Tenet box office. And here I'm going to remind everybody that we are not, or we have said that we're not going to make we're committing to the bit of not giving away stuff about Tenet because we know that a lot of people are still listening to the show and haven't yet had a chance to see it. Especially as it's struggling to find places to play in large spaces like New York and Los Angeles, where we have a lot of Real Blend listeners. But we want to talk specifically about how it's doing at the box office and what the indications are for that specifically. The movie did $20 million domestically in its first weekend. Gabe, you have $126 international, but it's not that, right? It's
That's more international that. Markets. Worldwide, $146.
So worldwide, $146. Yes.
I left a little bit of math for you to do, Sean.
And the combination that we think we've heard is that, what did we say, $450?
I read multiple places that $450 is the break-even number.
That's a lot of money. That is a lot of money for a movie to make.
Not normally, in a real-world scenario where things weren't, you know, in the middle of a worldwide pandemic, $450 sure. shouldn't be that tough for a Christopher Nolan summer.
No.
Blockbuster.
No, not
I mean,
at
even
all.
Dunkirk, which I would say is one of the harder sells of his career, got to that point or past that point, right, Kevin?
Dunkirk made over $500 million.
Yeah, so I don't think Tenet would have had an issue.
And Kevin's good for $500,000 himself individually. So
Dunkirk made $526 on $100 million budget.
So Tenet shouldn't have had an issue.
So it's impossible not to judge these numbers against the idea of how theaters are opening.
Yeah.
And people who are trying to compare it to past openings of other films, it just seems that's ridiculous. Like all of those normal measures feel out the window at this point for me. So when I saw 20 million, my initial reaction actually was, damn, that's really good. Because I thought that all theaters are at reduced capacity. Not even the majority of theaters are. I guess the majority of theaters in the country are open, right?
Sean, here is the major thing that we have to remind people of. The theaters are not open in New York or Los Angeles, two of the largest movie markets in the entire country, and San Francisco. And every theater that's open is between 25 to 40% capacity.
Yes.
And I think like 65 to 70% of the theaters in the country are open. Those are all you need to know to realize that the numbers that we're seeing for Tenet cannot be judged against anything.
In that case, 20 is pretty good.
Yeah, to give that some perspective, the widest release right now domestically for Tenet is 2,800 theaters, 2,800 limited capacity theaters. The widest release domestically for Dunkirk was 4,000 theaters, fully packed.
Oh my God.
I am much more interested in Tenet's week two numbers than I am week one.
Okay.
Now, if it plummets from 20 million to 5 million, that's when I start thinking, okay, maybe people aren't ready to go back to the theaters yet. But if it goes from 20 million to 15 million.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, because it may also, and also you have to keep in mind, it's not just how many theaters it's playing in or the capacity in which the theaters are allowing people to come in. It's also an X factor of like, are people ready to go back to has nothing to do with the quality of Tenet or if people want to see Tenet. It's whether or not people want to go to the movies, period.
Right.
Exactly. And I think that's an immeasurable factor.
So, Kev, as someone who's gone back multiple times, what has the experience been in terms of other people who are there? What does the theater look like when you go?
It's a good question.
So I've found it to be a very... personally a very safe experience. Now that being said, my mom and dad wouldn't go to a theater right now even if you paid them to. Like, there are people who just don't want to go to a movie theater,
and they are theater people. They go
they go once a week. They went once a week before the pandemic, and they will not go. They won't even come see me now that I've been to a movie theater, basically. They just don't want to see me. I don't blame them.
And people are coming. You're surrounded by people, a good amount of people.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, for me, it was me and my wife and her friend Lauren, and then there were like people scattered throughout the theater in their different sections. Everyone had a mask on. I did not have an issue. The only difference I will point out to the experience we talked about last week versus the experience this week. Last week I went to an early access showing on a Monday. This was a Saturday opening weekend normal public showing of the film.
That was the true example of probably what people experienced.
And I actually saw, this was actually kind of cool. So not only that I got my concessions and all that kind of stuff, but I used the sanitizer wipes. I wiped down my seats. When the movie ended, I walked out. There were four AMC employees standing there with these gigantic yellow sanitizing machines.
Oh, that's cool. Wow.
And they were all ready to go in, and they actually make more time in between the shows now so they can clean the entire theater. I'm not kidding when I say this. I would feel comfortable eating off the armrest of my seat.
I would never go that far. Like,
that's how clean it was, man. Wow. I'm telling you, I've never seen... I've walked through theaters with sticky stuff on my feet, armrests having all that gunk and nasty stuff in it. For me, it was like I felt like I had a private theater.
You know what? But unfortunately, all those machines were inverted, so whenever they went in, all the sanitation just came off the seats and went back into the big yellow machine.
I'm torn between theaters that have cloth seats now versus the ones that are more like that vinyl material.
Or this was like a leather, like the leather recliners, and for me again, it was It was cool because it was noon on a Saturday and people were just rolling in. It was like the old days. People were just walking in. Everyone looked excited. Everyone had masks on. It didn't feel that weird, to be honest with you. But again, personal threshold, whatever you're comfortable with.
I agree 100% with Jake that the second week number is going to be really interesting to see. I don't expect it to. I would love it if it stayed consistent. I don't see it necessarily going up.
No, it's not going to go up.
I hope it doesn't come down a whole heck of a lot. What I hope that it does is send an indication to the other blockbusters that are behind it that it's okay to try it. Like, is Wonder Woman 1984 comfortable now? You know, are they going to use 20 as that mark? Like, okay, we'll be comfortable with a 20 million opening if we're able to go worldwide. It's going to be interesting because
there any chance that we get Tenet on PVOD within the coming weeks?
No.
Where they try out the, like, hey, we'll put it in theaters for a month and then
any other movie? Yes. That movie? No. Okay. I don't think Nolan would let that.
If Unhinged isn't on PVOD, Tenet's not.
Yeah, but the difference is that people want to see Tenet.
That's a good point.
I'm sorry for all the.
Oh my god! Russell Crowe is going to be so mad at you.
I will say this: I do think Wonder Woman's going to have a bigger opening. It's a bigger film. Wonder Woman's a bigger film than Tenet. It is. I mean, Wonder Woman already, and it's a superhero film. It's name recognition. Tenet is an original film, original story.
Arguably, a superhero movie should do better. A sequel should do better.
I think Wonder Woman's going to have a bigger box office open. I don't think that's even a question of comparison because, like Tenet, for example, I'm sorry. Dunkirk, I think it was like a $55 million opening. I could be wrong. It's somewhere around the $50 million opening. And that was pre-pandemic and 4,000 screens. Then you had Tenet do $20 million on 2,800 screens with no New York, no LA, no San Francisco, and 30 to 40% capacity.
Here's the thing, though. Nolan would earn waves of goodwill if he released it on paid VOD. If he just relented and let more people see it.
How long afterwards?
I say a month.
Yeah, I think a month is fair. It's not. He got his theatrical run. Yeah. But there's people who physically are not able to go see it. You know, like it's just there's no theater open near them. And if he believes in, I know he believes in the theatrical experience. I think that's amazing. But if he also just believes in the movie as itself, he should want more people to be able to see it. And so I think a month is fair.
I actually, and this is going to sound crazy as somebody who's we're all theater advocates. I mean, I'm seeing the film multiple times. I think after a month, I would think that's fair.
Kev, then you wouldn't have to go to the theaters.
I'd still go to the theaters. I would still go.
I do want to sort of throw something out there. I'm curious to Sean specifically if you agree with this. For people who are keeping up with the box office reporting and sort of the tracking, and be very weary of who's writing it and the potential slant that it's taken. And what I mean by that is
I know exactly who you're talking about.
A lot of press out there that are quite honestly annoyed or perhaps even borderline angry at Nolan and or Warner Brothers because either they haven't had a chance to see the film, mm-hmm. or potentially maybe they did not get Christopher Nolan for an interview. And that has
Unlike
the potential
us.
To... I'm not saying that. But I'm just saying that I have read some very interesting perceptions of how they're skewing these box office numbers.
Yeah.
And I can't help but feel like, do you just have a little bit of a chip on your shoulder because you haven't seen the movie yet? Like, are you rooting for it to fail unfairly because it has not benefited you personally?
And so I would just
say,
like,
I would just say, be careful reading any box office numbers that come to any kind of drastic conclusions without taking into account unprecedented worldwide events unlike anything Hollywood's ever dealt with.
It has been highly unusual to see noted film journalists take the stance of movies and movie theaters and movie studios should fail. Like, I don't understand that perspective.
I understand the idea of I am making a conscious choice
sure.
to not go to the, like, that is your right. And that is a right I respect. And I,
sure.
What I don't agree with is, and I've seen this and I know you guys, I assume you guys have seen it too. It does seem like there are people who are actively rooting for Tenet to be a disaster to almost justify their choice. Like it almost feels like, especially a lot of the people that are in New York or LA, like, I couldn't be a part of this. Therefore, I hope this movie fails.
I want to ask a hypothetical. If this was not Tenet, but it was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, do you think people would be taking the same stance, or would they be championing Quentin fighting to get his movie into theaters?
It does almost feel like Nolan, like, people have their like the knives out for Nolan. Like, I feel like there's something of, like, as much as we love Nolan, and
that was Ryan Johnson's movie.
Hey, hey, eat shit. But it sort of feels like people kind of were
that's what I'm saying.
Coming for Nolan.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. That if Quentin was the one pushing this, I think there's a lot more people in the film Twitter atmosphere that would be backing Quentin.
Yeah, he has
in a
more
way
goodwill.
That they are not backing.
But what
Nolan
did
right
Nolan
now.
Do?
He's just made a string of amazing films.
And Quentin hasn't?
I don't
also,
know. I don't know.
Can we be clear here that Nolan is not forcing anyone to go to a movie theater?
No.
There's no forcing happening
nor
here.
Is
it's just
he...
a choice.
Exactly. Yes. And
it's
so
a choice. It's, yeah.
I would love to hear his take on the box office. I really would. I'd love to know what his opinions are, whether he's happy with this, sad with this, but he'll never comment because it doesn't benefit him in either way, shape or form. Let's jump to a movie that did go to paid VOD. Paid, I'm going to mention, because even though you're a subscriber to Disney Plus, you paid an additional $30 to see Mulan. I found this to be unusual in the fact that when I watched it, and I'm going to lead with the fact that the original animated feature is not a sacred film to me by any stretch. I don't even know what year it came out, but whatever year it came out, I was not paying attention to Disney animated films at that point anymore. So I maybe have seen the first Mulan, the animated Mulan once. If even that. So I thoroughly enjoyed this live action retelling of it. I thought it was epic. I thought it looked great. I loved its use of locations. I love the sets that it built. I thought the main actress was fantastic. I really just got on board with the storytelling of it. I actually did a video review for it and where I called it Disney's take on Game of Thrones. And then you guys watched it and weighed in, and Jake came in hot with how much he hated it. And then
so
Kevin sort
bad.
Of fell in the middle.
It's so bad.
I can't see how we are that far apart.
Bad.
It's
that
not.
Is
but
a
that's
bad.
The thing.
Movie.
Why is it bad? Explain
it's,
to me why
it's middle
bad.
Of the road.
No, it is bad. Because it one
it's
moment it feels like it it's wants to bad. Be this historical sweeping epic that captures a moment in history and really and then one
it
moment it
that.
Feels it actually feels like it's a live action recreation of like the sticky like some of like the animation jokes because there's a lot of stuff in the world of animation that plays in animation that just doesn't play in live action, and it felt like they couldn't decide which one they wanted to go to, so they were sort of tiptoeing in both. There were a lot of the sequences that kind of just felt like they were like shot like they it just looked cheap to me, honestly. That I don't get
that's
the
why I push back. I thought the location
cheap.
Shots
oh,
looked really
I thought it
great
looked, and
really
the
great.
Edit it was so like rapid, like it felt like it was like made by a lot of inexperienced people that were capitalizing on our goodwill for this story. I didn't think any of the performances were any like notable at all.
Are you talking about Solo?
Hey.
What are you referring to here?
It was not good. And here's the thing. I clearly don't have a great history of loving
good films.
These live action. Hey, let's go back to some of the comments we get, shall we? I obviously don't like the Disney live action ones, but I am on record as having been hopeful for this one because I felt like, oh, they're going to go in a different direction. They're going to almost give us like a completely new film. It's almost going to be like it was not good. In fact, it was actively bad. It had no idea what kind of movie it wanted to be, and it was made by people that didn't really know how to make a movie.
Oh, God, Kevin, back me up here a little bit, please.
I mean, listen, I think the film is incredibly visually gorgeous. I think it was the scale of it's huge. I thought the shots were incredible. I love the use of the camera, the sideways shots during the action sequences I thought were really cool. I also thought the sets were beautiful. There's this one incredible shot in the beginning as we're going around the area where the characters live and we're just going.
That just looks cheap to me.
It looked like it was real set.
No, that looks so cheap to me. It looks cheap.
They filmed in New Zealand. What, like the mountains and the scenery, it's all
sure,
legit.
Like that, but like this, the sets themselves looks cheap to
me. You're nitpicking.
Jake watched Larry Crown again, didn't you? Yeah. You watched Larry Crown again.
I'll watch Larry Crown again before I watch Mulan. I'll tell you that right now.
I mean.
All right. On a serious note, I thought the problem I have with Mulan, I don't think it's a great film. I don't think it's a bad film. I think it's just right in the middle. I think there's some great elements too. I think the performances were great. My problem with Mulan is this, and Sean, just like you, I did not have an attachment to the animated film. It was actually one of the few of animated Disney films that I just wasn't on my radar.
Yeah.
I knew all about it. Lauren knew all about it. So I watched the original prior to watching this Mulan. And I think the thing about the first Mulan that I love so much is that the journey the character goes on, the adversity she has to go through in order to become the character we see at the end of the story, there's an uphill battle to that journey that you root for her actively. You're going uphill against the pressure. In this film, it felt like it was just too easy for her to get from point A to point B in the sense that they didn't, I don't think they gave the character, they didn't give the character enough adversity because the whole point of the story, at least from my perspective, is that we're all equal. Men and women should be able to choose what they want to do with their lives. Mm-hmm. And the idea that a woman has to marry and not become a warrior is a ridiculous notion. And I think the idea of giving her a quote unquote chi, the aspect of her kind of like a superpower almost cheapened her arc as well. I felt like, why can't she just be a woman? And that's the reason why she overcomes this adversity.
So was that in the animated movie, though? Because I don't know anything about this chi. That was
I don't
very
remember
new to me
her
also.
Having a chi. And I was talking to a friend of mine named Lauren, Lauren's friend Lauren, who's a huge Mulan fan. And these were actually sentiments that she completely agreed with. She was saying that, like, I don't know why they had to give her a chi in order, or this whatever this superpower element was.
It almost like her to like, felt like, the, this. Like she was like she was the one. It almost felt like the Matrix. Where like she had kind of like she was Neo, and it's like
exactly.
You know, she could have just been a person. Movies feel like coloring books. These movies feel like they're like, as opposed to the original Mulan, which kind of felt like an organic drawing of a story.
Yes.
This feels like a story that's already there, and they're just coloring in different sequences. Yeah. They're just coloring in the blanks. Like you already know what the picture is. So here's this piece colored. Like it just.
And it's a good way to put it because that's exactly kind of how it felt. It was almost like, okay, we know she has to have this arc.
Yeah.
Let's just get
yeah.
her there.
Here's this mark. Let's go.
There was no. It just for me. I love a journey of adversity. I love a journey of a character pushing up against something. And yes, she does in the film. But it just didn't grab me. And I think at the same time, visually, it's gorgeous. I thought it was gorgeously scored. Again, performance wise, I thought I actually loved her and her father's relationship. That to me was the best part of the movie. That her and her father's relationship in the film, because I think that's a great story. The idea that this daughter who wasn't allowed to be a warrior could save the fight and prove her family wrong, but also honor her family at the same time. It's a great arc. It's a great story. But for me, like Jake and I were just saying, why couldn't she just be a woman? And that's the reason why she overcomes the adversity.
My litmus test for these things is always, always, would you watch this either as an alternative to the animated film or in place of? And it's for me, it's no. No, and I don't think that many people would say yes.
Weirdly enough, the one thing that I keep seeing online that people are complaining about is the thing I'm glad they didn't do, because you couldn't really do the Mushu character in the live action, the Eddie Murphy character.
That would have been
painful.
I
do love that. But I do love that character in the animated film.
Sure.
But that also goes to what Jake was saying about the jokey things you can do with kind of an animation.
At the beginning, when she was like balancing all the teapots and everything, it's just like, what are you doing? Like, what movie are you making? Pick a lane.
It didn't have a grounded sense. Like, I think I completely understand where Jake is coming from. I don't think the movie was bad, but I actually more understand where Jake's coming from than the idea of it being a great film. I think it has great aspects to it. But I just thought it was underwhelming, personally.
So, not to go down a rabbit hole, but like Simu Liu, who's going to play Shang-Chi for Marvel, he commented about Mulan, and it was a thread, and I just went down the thread of responses, and they were all hysterical, where he was just like, just once, I would love for screenwriters to not write Asian characters who are compelled to, hold up the family honor. And every response underneath was from Asian people who were just like, I fucking love honor. Like, you can't get enough honor. And I never thought about the fact that, like, too many movies that they're being given, you know, that's just like, this is coming from a major studio and your character really wants to live up to the family honor. I was like, oh, yeah, that is really an overused trope, isn't it? But I guess if you're telling Mulan, that's Mulan.
Was there ever any criticism about the characters not speaking Chinese? Like the idea that the characters have, like, they speak English. I found that, like, even in a live action world, I think in the animated world, it didn't bother me much. But in the live action world, I'm like looking at these characters and they are and they're in their homeland.
Yeah.
And I just it took me out to think they're all speaking perfect English.
I think that's strange.
I would say that's going a little too far, because it's a Disney movie, and we got to think about that. They're trying to introduce this to a bunch of kids, and like,
true,
you know.
But you know what I did learn?
I think that might be a step too far for like a 6-year-old to enjoy the film.
Oh no, you know? I'm not saying you would make a major $200 million movie like this with Chinese language and then subtitle. I just think it took me out a little bit. No, like, I just found it weird that everybody in the film spoke perfect English. Sure. Like, I just found that to be strange. Like, I didn't immerse myself in the world as much as I wanted to, because I kept thinking about things like that.
I think the criticism that I've been seeing more often than that is that the executives and the creatives outside of the cast are all white, and that being a big issue of that they're trying to adapt this story and tell this story. And something that you just mentioned pointing out, it's a very stereotypical motivation for an Asian character versus what you might get from an Asian person writing the story who wants to tell a fresh story. So that's been the biggest criticism I've seen.
Gabe, think about Parasite, for example, Korean film. Imagine watching that film.
Yeah, but that's English. my point though, is Parasite's not for 6-year-olds.
True, I get that.
It might be off, but it is a big budget. You know,
imagine
when they make a Batman movie, they dub it in Spanish in Spain. You know,
if they dropped Mulan with subtitles and was like, "Read, kids."
but at that point, it becomes like a Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon thing. Like then it sort of kind of felt like they were going for a crouching, like the action sequences to me.
Yeah,
were watered down Crouching Tiger.
To ground this in what I think their target audience was. To point to our weekly poll, while only like 20-something% of people said, yes, they're going to buy it, the comments under that were emphatic yeses from parents who were saying, a movie for my kids to watch right now after all? Like,
yes.
Yeah. Like, so again, to ground that in what the audience is, like, we got to think of the 6-year-old kid who needs to be able to
Gay brings up a good point, because like when I got back into the office this week, one of my anchors came up to me and she said my husband and I rented Mulan or bought Mulan this weekend with our son, and we absolutely loved it. And that's the thing. I know a major Hollywood motion picture is not going to go that route and kind of use the actual language and then subtitle it. I just feel like in terms of immersion, when you're trying to immerse yourself in a world in the actual living of the characters, especially a movie that is specifically about that story, it just weirdly enough threw me off a little bit.
I'm not even making a joke. I wonder if I would imagine that this is going to be dubbed in Chinese for the Chinese market. I wonder if you could ever get your hand on that and watch it and see if that for you how that changes the feeling of the movie. That's interesting.
I'd be interested in seeing. Like, I mean, it's funny
I hate
when you
dubbing.
watch think about dubbing. I don't like subtitles. I do. But think about Kill Bill, for example. Major motion picture. Anytime we're in an environment.
Again, it's not for 6-year-olds.
Yeah, like, that's true. I'm just saying. But like, but there is a level of immersion you lose.
Yeah,
in that particular instance, I think.
Yeah, but there's a level of complete understanding that a 6-year-old loses if they have to try to read.
I want to see Quentin's Mulan. Is what I would like to see. Honestly,
his 10th and final film.
That would be amazing.
All animated.
Has there ever been a multi-hundred million dollar American released film that was in the actual language of the story? Have we ever seen something like that?
Crouching Tiger doesn't count because it wasn't.
It was a Chinese film. Ang Lee made that as a Chinese film.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
The one I was going to bring up, and only because I learned this over the course of us talking about Chadwick Boseman, was him explaining why he fought so hard for T'Challa to have a South African accent and how Marvel wanted him to have a British accent as if to say. So I actually sat through Peter Travers has a show on TV still called like Popcorn Talk or Popcorn with Peter Travers. And it was on Saturday at 2:30, the hot spot of Saturday at 2:30.
Is this where Chadwick sings?
I didn't get that far, but I did hear him explain why he had the accents. And it's really Peter Travers, with all due respect. And so Michelle was ripping into him and I kind of did stop her and say like, hey, look, if he doesn't do this, like we don't ever get a chance to. He's a trailblazer. He absolutely went first, but he just asked the hackiest questions, like really hacky questions, like things that in a junket you would just never ask. And one of them was about the accent. And Chadwick gave an amazing answer about how if he had a British accent, it would have implied that he would have had to leave Wakanda in order to get better education. And the idea should be that the best of everything is in Wakanda, so he should be staying in Wakanda. And Peter Travers asked a follow-up question, like a very obvious follow-up question, because he just wanted him to use the accent. And then Chadwick Boseman went on to give a longer answer about, well, this is the dialect that I used, and here's where I listened to a lot of different ones. And I literally said to Michelle, I was like, please don't ask another question because I know you just want him to do the accent. Please don't. And Peter's like, well, what, like if you were to hear him talk right now, what would, and then Chad was literally like, cringed. Well, I guess he'd sound like this, blah, 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 and he did the accent. And I was like, I hate you, Peter. Strong you. But
did he seem uncomfortable doing it?
Oh, totally. He really did. He saw through it and was literally just like, you're going to keep asking me until I do it. So here you go. Here's one sentence in the accent. But, can we please move on?
But to your point, how important is that accent?
It immersed you in Wakanda. That's the point.
Completely changes the perspective. Sure. Like if he had a British or an American accent,
yes,
it would completely take you out of the film. But I completely see where Gabe's coming from. I just think as an immersion story point, it pulls me out a little bit. That's all.
This week in movies, Sony is going theatrical, semi-theatrical with a film called The Broken Hearts Gallery. I've heard about this movie, but I don't really know anything about it. Has anyone seen it?
I think I have. Are we doing interviews for that this week?
Broken Hearts Gallery. He's got to go to his phone.
Isn't Dacre Montgomery in that?
I'll giant calendar.
If
you don't have it. I think Dacre Montgomery's in that. He's the actor from Stranger Things. He was the villain in Stranger Things season 3.
I'm going to guess you guys haven't seen it, though.
I haven't seen it, no.
Okay. Well, I did see Unpregnant. Neither of you guys have seen Unpregnant yet? HBO Max movie?
I have not.
September 10th. Really sweet movie. But here's the thing, too. So Haley Lou Richardson plays a high schooler who becomes pregnant. And it starts off right off the bat. She's taking a pregnancy test at her high school. She learns that she's pregnant and she wants to get an abortion. And this movie really just is open and candid and works in some very bold, I thought, stances on how ridiculous a lot of the laws are that prevent a girl from getting an abortion if she chooses to. She happens to live in Missouri. She has to drive all the way to Albuquerque, New Mexico in order to get, because she's underage. She's 17, the character. And the only place that she can go is Albuquerque that would allow her to get one without a parent present. And the point of the movie ends up becoming, it's a road trip movie. She goes with a girl who, an estranged best friend who she grew up with, but the two of them grew apart in high school. And this is the only girl who she kind of trusts to take her on this trip. And the girl also has a car. And the point of the movie ends up becoming, after all of the sort of goofy road trip cliches, Haley Richardson's character ends up saying, like, isn't it ridiculous that I have to drive hundreds of miles in order to get an operation that I'm choosing to get. And I thought it was really refreshing and courageous to see a comedy take on this stance. And it just fit all of that stuff. So I love the message. I think the two leads had fantastic chemistry. It falls a little bit too much into, you know, when you're in on a road trip comedy movie like that, there's a bunch of plot contrivances that you watch and you're just like, okay, this would never happen. Like at one point they're talking about, I don't want to give that away. That's too much of a twist. Anyway, there's a bunch of things that happen that end up like leading to a few cameos where you're just like, all right, this wouldn't happen at this point now, but you ride it out because the two of them are really, really good together. It ends up being really, really sweet. And I loved the progressive messages of just saying, hey, look, this is my choice. And it's ridiculous how laws are written in today's day and age that prevent me from being able to do those things. So Unpregnant, check it out on HBO Max. It starts dropping on September 10th, so a little bit earlier than the weekend. Let's roll into this week's Blend Game. And we were talking about Chadwick Boseman and his contributions to Black Panther. To continue to honor the legacy of the actor and the work that he left behind, we are playing hashtag Chadwick Boseman Blend, where we're giving our favorite Chadwick Boseman films or performances, specifically because we're discussing an actor, and I would like Kevin to go first.
Well, I mean, I'm going to go first, but I'm also, Sean, I guess we can just go together.
I think we have the same one.
Yeah, and I think Captain America Civil War, I think we'll both touch on why. Mm-hmm. I it's so fun, interesting to me, because I love Black Panther, but as I look at Black Panther, I don't just think of Chadwick. And I guess the same thing happens with Civil War as well. But I thought Black Panther was a very strong ensemble piece. You know what I mean? It was like, you know, everybody in that film, Lupita, you know, you're talking about, Michael B. Jordan. Everybody in that film was incredible. It was a pure ensemble piece.
Yep.
And for me, when I look at Black Panther, yes, I love Chadwick in that film, but I much prefer his performance and his arc, in my opinion, personally, in Civil War. I love what happens with his sequence with his father. Obviously, that, you know, I don't love his father dying, but I love the idea of like what it does to the character and kind of how it builds the arc of the character. And I think that for me, learning more about him through being introduced in Civil War, oddly enough, my favorite Tom Holland appearance in the MCU is in that film as well. Mm-hmm. And he's had his own Spider-Man films as well. But I think that Chadwick's performance in Civil War, it was the introduction to the character. I thought that within a scope of all these characters in this insane airport sequence, I still honed in on his performance. He was that good. He stood out so much as a supporting character within Civil War. He held his own weight. Like, I feel like Civil War, while it was a Captain America film, it felt like a very much like an Avengers film. But I do think that Chadwick's performance as Black Panther stood out. I mean, specifically that chase on the street with the flip over with the motorcycle. Remember that whole sequence? It was it's unbelievable. I actually think Civil War is probably my favorite rendition of seeing Black Panther on screen. Wow. I love the Black Panther film, but I genuinely love Civil War. And I think that his performance in that is incredible.
Well, and part of it is because it's for the first time we're seeing a lot of the choices that he made to bring the character to life.
Yeah, emotionally.
You're hearing the actor for the first time. You're getting a sense of the people who are committed to him because you get some of the people who are around him. They do an amazing job. Again, the Russos, who's surprised, but they do an amazing job of not just introducing him, but making sure that his arc in that movie is significant. It's nuts when you think of the number of things that happen in Civil War and no one feels shortchanged. Tony Stark gets a legitimate arc. It's a Captain America movie. They tie T'Challa's journey to Bucky, so that's important. Spider-Man gets introduced and is proper. Like, all of the heroes have significant things going on, and the Russos don't drop any of them. But the reason why I pick Civil War also is because, just like Kevin said, and he's right, I almost think, and it's not a slight to Chadwick in the least bit, but he gets overshadowed in Black Panther by almost everyone else. Everyone else is so good, and especially Killmonger. Especially the performance of Michael B. Jordan as the villain. And there's times when the villain is more colorful or flamboyant or choose a little bit more scenery in a movie and they overshadow their villain or they overshadow their hero. It's easier for the villain to sort of stand out. And I think that a little bit happens to Chadwick in his Black Panther movie, as great as that film is. So I'm also picking Captain America Civil War because I just thought he made a commanding first appearance as a significant role. And I told this story. I forget where I told it now. I think I tweeted it. I drove down from Charlotte to Atlanta to see a press screening of Captain America Civil War because we weren't getting a screening of it in Charlotte. It was an opportunity to see it early. And for me, it was Spider-Man's introduction into the MCU. And I couldn't have been more geeked. Like, literally just the hyper nerdiness powered me through a drive to Atlanta, 4 hours down, wow, for 7 p.m. screening. And I was not staying overnight. So when I got out of the screening at 9:30, you know, bordering on 10 o'clock, I turned around and drove home. I would have done it 3 nights in a row if I needed to, because I just needed to see that movie. And the first comment I gave to the rep when I walked out of the screening, she said, hey, what'd you think? And I said, Black Panther was incredible. Because I didn't love Black Panther growing up. I'm not invested in the character, but Chadwick was so commanding in that part, that was my first initial reaction to responding to that movie. And that's even with Spidey coming on. So, I'm also choosing Captain America Civil War. Jake, are you also choosing it?
I'm not. I'm actually choosing Black Panther, okay, which, it's interesting because I actually prefer Civil War as a movie.
Yeah.
But I prefer his performance in Black Panther because I understand the argument about the ensemble thing, because it is. It's such a massive ensemble. But I think the reason that I am picking him in Black Panther is because I would argue, despite the fact that it is such a massive ensemble with such an incredible collection of characters that do a lot with a little bit of screen time, I still think Chadwick Boseman towers over that film. And even a portion of the film in which he disappears, he's still there. And really, you know, oftentimes, even though we had seen him in another Marvel movie, you know, Black Panther was kind of like the origin movie. We at least, like, he becomes Black Panther and all the struggles it gets to that point. A lot of times, even within the MCU, these origin stories tend to be a little bit of paint by numbers. There are certain beats they got to hit, mm-hmm, to get them to that point. But I just felt like because he had already been set up and we sort of knew who he was able to fit so much of that character into that first origin movie. And because he was able to fit in so many different story beats, was able to show such a wide range of emotions with this character. And I mean, he showed strength. He showed vulnerability. He showed weakness. He showed he died, you know, like there are so many aspects that he was able to fit into that one movie, so much so that I like the movie Black Panther. It's not one of my favorite MCUs. It's probably middle of the range for me. I much prefer the movie Civil War in terms of the wide range of MCU, but I thought his performance in Black Panther was unquestionably just unbelievable. And honestly, had that, I know it was a big player at the Oscars, but had he been nominated for Best Actor for Black Panther, I wouldn't have blinked an eye. I would have said, good for him. Okay, well done. Just imagine what he could have done with Black Panther 2, with the foundation that had already been laid.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, and to Jake's point, though, I will say this. To lead a film like Black Panther is a lot of work.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you're the lead. Mm-hmm. And
the weight on his shoulder.
Yeah, and I remember, like, when I spoke to him for Black Panther specifically, I reached out to his drama, his directing teacher at Howard University.
Oh, well, cool.
And she gave me a question to deliver to Chadwick.
That's so cool.
about leading, about being a leading man, leading actor in Hollywood. And the question was about the idea of kind of like, what's it like to be a leading man in the films that you're in? Like, he was talking about, you know, Get On Up, 42. And he said,
how did he react when you pulled that video out?
Oh, I mean, Chadwick Boseman was like, he's a super chill guy, so he was just like, oh, it's my teacher. Like, he was like, you know, it was a cool moment, but like he wasn't the most like explosive like type of interview. He was very like chill, very serious, I found, but in a very respectful and great way. And I remember him just going through this amazing answer about what it's like to lead a film and what like and how the lead actor of the film is also kind of a director of the movie. He is the character is the one that kind of has to tell the other actors where they are and what they're doing. It's very much like a director being the leading man in a film. Not saying that a leading actor of every film directs the movie, but there's a sense of responsibility that person has. So to Jake's point, it's actually interesting. Black Panther is probably the tougher performance because you're dealing with the leading character. You are the leading man in the film. So I actually go both ways here. And as much as I like Black Panther, I do prefer Civil War. But at the end of the day, the weight of what Black Panther meant and the what he was able to do as the leading character, I do think is something that you can't deny.
Have you guys rewatched it since he passed? Yeah.
No. I watched Black Panther two days after he passed away.
It hits differently, man.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest. Now, Apple TV is pushing it hard. Whenever you're in their main menu, it's one of the first things that it's like, hey, like we have, and I got to be, every time that image pops up, it's a little bit of a gut punch. It's you know, hard, it's, man. It's, I'm not quite sure I'm ready to rewatch it just yet.
I think what's interesting about Black Panther on a rewatch is, and apologies, by the way, anybody on video, I was on my phone. I was texting one of my producers from work. I apologize to anyone think I was being rude. I don't think anybody does, but anyways.
Kevin, why did you text
me? We juggle a lot.
Sean's shirt is stupid. Why are you texting me that? I just wanted to explain.
My producer was asking me a question about something from
work. Your producer is gay. That's all the producer you have.
Gabe. All right, so real quick, though, one thing I will say, though, is that when it comes to Black Panther on the rewatch, there's a scene when he goes to visit his father in this afterlife. Of scenario, yeah. And that scene hits way differently knowing where we are now and with him passing away. Going back real quick to Civil War, the one thing I want to say about it, and I touched on this in my explanation, I think what I love about Civil War and Sean is that he stood out so much in a film that he didn't necessarily need to stand out in.
No, not
it was
at all.
Like, do you know what I mean? It was like you watched, he gave so much weight to every scene he was in that he made it matter. And to me, I feel like if you could stick out like that in a gigantic film like that, other than just being the title of your film, which is Black Panther, clearly you're going to stand out in that movie.
Sure.
I just find that to me was interesting because as a performance, he really, really nailed it and made the character important and not just a throwaway and not just an introduction. It was actually a genuine, fully arced character.
And for that, I'll give credit to the Russos and probably even Feige. Because honestly, from a big picture point of view, you include him to set up his next movie.
And it was more than that.
It was so much more than that.
Way more than just a setup. It wasn't just like, oh, here's Black Panther. We'll see him in the It was a fleshed out.
Well, Marcus and McFeely too, I guess. By tying him to Bucky, it makes it really important. But it's,
and his dad dying is what sets off the whole story.
It does. Yes. Very much so. Yes.
T'Challa's story is what anchors Civil War.
Jeez, I think Black Panther was the character who was sitting with the villain, Daniel Brühl's character at the end, isn't he? Good Lord.
I rewatched Civil War and Black Panther back to back after Bozeman passed.
It's not
which is why I kind of had this perspective
it's
of
not
like
those two.
What?
It's not those two though. It's not. Oh, it's not Infinity War and Endgame. But it is great. It's definitely great.
Civil War is top five MCU.
God, now I'm gonna watch it tonight.
Yeah,
God,
Civil War is top five for me. Go.
All right. So Randy Buss, Michelle Garrist, and Kimberly Sue both said 42, and many, many others also said 42. Aiden Erdahl, Ray Perkins, Michael Breen, and many, many others said Black Panther. Jake was sort of saying, I wish we had more films to choose from. The one thing we talked about with Chadwick Boseman and his legacy is that we lament the stories that he did not get a chance to tell.
And it's hard not to pick Black Panther, just in terms of performance and just what that character
meant.
Someone
said I guess I kind of understand this comparison. They said it would almost be like playing Christopher Reeve and not choosing Superman.
But we still chose Black Panther, technically speaking. Yeah. We chose the character. Sure. It's just a different movie. But going back to Black Panther on the rewatch, Michael B. Jordan, him and Michael B. Jordan at that end scene might be one of the most emotional things I've ever seen. Why do I care for a guy who's killed over 130 people?
Yeah.
Because Coogler and the performances and Chadwick, that scene is masterful.
He's amazing.
Oh, all right. The wide shot in the fall. Oh.
For next week, you can reach out on Twitter. We're going to be playing hashtag, I can't believe we haven't done this before. And Kevin, I'm going to have to put a limitation on you. Hashtag Gary Oldman blend. So do we say you can't play True Romance?
Why?
Is that fair?
That's fine.
That's like a default.
It's by default. Okay. I have my other one.
All right. Hashtag Gary Oldman blend. So you can let us know your pick via social media if you want to.
That's
you
a
can
also good one. Email I think mine's going to freaking blow your mind.
realblend@cinemablend.com. Can you what?
Can I put a little side note for our audience real quick?
Yeah.
There's a movie that Gary Oldman stars in, which is arguably one of the worst films I've ever seen in my entire life. It's called Tiptoes.
Yeah.
And it is so bad. And I don't think anybody know it exists, but it has Gary Oldman, Matthew McConaughey, and Kate Beckinsale. Seek it out if you want to see one of the worst movies ever. It's incredibly offensive and very bad.
All right. Well, I'm fascinated to see if anybody chooses that for next week. All right. You can send us a review also at realblend@cinemablend.com. This week's review comes to us from someone named Jeremiah Battle, who writes, "Hey guys, my name is Jeremiah Battle, and I've been a huge fan of your podcast for 6 to 7 months now. I don't know why it's taken me this long to write a review, but better late than never." I totally agree with you, Jeremiah. Better late than never. As a person who loves films and wants to be a screenwriter director, watching your podcast each and every week gives me something to look forward to. Seeing filmmakers of all capacities come on the show and talk about their careers and behind the scenes stories, ideas, and processes is super interesting and inspiring. And watching you guys ooze your film love is something that I can appreciate and relate to.
Such an interesting choice of words.
Such a personal level, because me and my friends act the same way. I wouldn't have chosen ooze there. I get what he's saying, but yeah, that's an uncomfortable.
Secrete?
The secret of the ooze. Wasn't that the Ninja Turtles movie?
Yes. Yeah. This is really great. When the week is going badly, when it's exhausting, even unbearable, I always think to myself, well, at least I'll get to watch Real Blend this week. And that's something that's so special to me, because to me, you guys are more than some guys on a screen talking about movies. To me, you guys feel like a family, a film family that I get to tune into each and every week. So when I first read that review on the email, I clipped that part out and sent it to the guys just to remind them that this little show that we put together is growing in ways that none of us ever predicted.
And that we're never allowed to quit, ever.
Kevin, Jake, Sean, and Gabe, Real Blend is something so special, and I thank you so much for sharing your loving, heated, thoughtful, and passionate discussions about films and putting it out there for the world to hear. This podcast is a true marvel. Thank you for inspiring a young, aspiring filmmaker to make films that one day, hopefully, all you guys will love to watch. Dunkirk, Tenant, or whatever it is now that you've changed it to. Well, we haven't changed it to much of anything, so we'll still figure it out as we get closer to the thing. Okay, plugs. And thank you, Jeremiah, for that review.
That review was great. Is
outstanding.
Thank you very much.
Please continue to send your reviews to us at realblend@cinemablend.com, or go to the iTunes app and leave us a review there. Just keep the kind words flowing. We really appreciate it. Tease, Real Blend Premium. This week we're going to be doing our favorite memories from TIFF. So for people who don't get the joke at the beginning of the show, this week, every year is when we're normally in Toronto. And there's been a number of events that have just not happened this year because of COVID. And none of them have really affected me quite the way that not being in Toronto has affected me. Like, we didn't go to San Diego for Comic-Con, or we didn't go to Vegas for CinemaCon, all these things that are normal. But the first week in September...
This weekend I was actually... It was weird. I was doing my fantasy football draft with my buddies, and at one point someone was like, "Why have we never done it over this weekend before? Like, why is this the first time?" And I kind of thought, like, why is this the first? And I was like, yeah, because I'm normally in Toronto, so I normally can't do the fantasy football draft this time.
It hurts. So we're going to do a Real Blend Premium episode and talk about some of our favorite memories of being up at that film festival, which has been truly outstanding. If you guys want to subscribe to the Real Blend Premium and you haven't yet, go to bit.ly/RealBlendPremium. So until next week, you can follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, and at Sean_O'Connell. You can drop us a review on iTunes, which means a ton to us, and we will be back here next week with all new. Oh, and there's also a bonus episode, which you probably could have listened to by now. It's Bring It On, Peyton Reed and Jessica Bendinger, the screenwriter, and they're celebrating 20 years of Bring It On. So you can download that right now. It's available for you. And we'll be back next week with all new episodes of Real Blend. Until then, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
I like that movie.
Don't be a menace to South Central while drinking your juice in the hood.
You want to get the Wayans Brothers
on? I don't think Fincher directed that,
I love that,
dude.
Movie.
I don't think Fincher directed that
movie.
Have
you guys not seen
movie.
That? No, it's amazing. I love that movie.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.